My name's Peter Wilson, and I'm an academic leader for literature and writing at the University of North, now London Metropolitan University. And on behalf of the university and the Freud Museum and the Institute of Psychoanalysts, I'd like to welcome you here tonight, coordinated as we are by the Rowan Arts Project. This is another event in the Connecting Conversations series designed to forge links between psychoanalysis and other disciplines, including obviously literature and the arts. It's a privilege tonight to have Andrew Motion with us in conversation with Dennis Flynn. Andrew, as I'm sure you all know, is the Poet Laureate. I think most recently and relevantly in my mind anyway, is his role as a memoirist with his wonderful evocation of childhood, boyhood and youth in the blood, which I'm really hoping will be at least part of the topic of conversation tonight. Dennis is a child psychotherapist, a member and child analyst of the British Psychoanalytical Society, and the author, among other things, of the important book Severe Emotional Disturbance in Children and Adolescents. The format of these events is two halves, really. Andrew and Dennis are going to converse connectingly for about 45 minutes around the relation, in this case, between personal thought and its public revelation, which is obviously a very relevant theme for this evening. I think it's a relevant theme, not just for poetry and memoir, but for psychoanalysis itself. There'll be approximately 45 minutes for a discussion with the audience afterwards. And we have a bookstall and a variety of other literature about the activities of Connecting Conversations, and I'll mention more about that afterwards. But for now, we welcome Andrew and Dennis.
Okay, well, I'd like to start, and I'm very pleased to meet you and to be able to talk with you, Andrew. And I hope that some of the things that we can talk about will range across your work, your poetry, and the work of biography, and the autobiography, the memoir, and some of the poems related to it, which I think you've brought out over the years. Having read your work, I was struck by a theme that began to emerge, which was something that did actually connect what we try and do in psychoanalysis and what you're doing in poetry. And there is a way that that psychoanalysis aims to give people the opportunity to express their very personal thoughts, often their contradictions and conflicts and twists and turns of their approach to life, and to give expression to that. And I certainly think that when you're with somebody in a consulting room, you quite often hear something that from many people, not just the odd literary person, but for many people, a kind of expression of their own thought, which actually becomes almost poetic. And I think there's a sense almost in which while struggling with conflicts and thinking about things, one actually gains in some sense or finds a poetic voice. And I think that, as I understand it from reading a lot of your work, is something that's concerned you. I think people probably think psychoanalysis is a rather, broad brush set of theories, about repression, about symbolism of unconscious material. about inner conflict, about, you know, finding contact with something that's more kind of alive and life-directed, you know, rather than something troubling that gets in the way of life. But I think in some ways, although, you know, those kinds of theories and understandings are there in poetry, I think they're, as I see it in modern poetry, they're there around the edges or in the background. I mean, there may be elements of those. What I think I, you know, read, and particularly read in some of your work, is, you know, is about the contradictions of feeling, is about thoughts that come, is about, I think as you put it to me on the phone when we spoke, you know, something about kind of saying what we know but reaching into areas that we don't know, and always on that kind of spectrum. I suppose I've read on one of the jackets of one of your books that someone had just described you as founding a narrative school of poetry.
Well, that's not true.
I wondered what it meant. Anyway, whether that's true or not, what I wanted to ask, maybe to get it rolling, is perhaps, you know, what you think about some of these ideas, what, you know, you think about what the poet does, what you try and do in poetry.
Well, having raised a lot of extremely interesting and intense questions, you end with something that is so enormous that I hardly know where to begin. But that I will begin perhaps by trying to answer some of the things that came through in what you were saying before you got to your enormous final question. I'm going to forget a lot of what I mean to say about this en route, so forgive me. But appropriately, I suppose the first thing to say is that I think you're right that there are various similarities between the activities that you, as a therapist, and I guess there are others in the room who are engaged in similar sorts of activity in the room, that you, plural, the activities that you, plural, as therapists take, and the kind of activities that we as writers take, in two respects particularly. One is that we're both very, I mean, we poets and you therapists are very interested in symbolic language. We don't expect that what we're hearing to be either what we're hearing ourselves say or what we're hearing our patients, you are hearing your patients say, to be something which is only interesting on account of what it says on the surface. We expect to be able to look through that surface down into the larger and more cohesive or indeed disruptive things underneath it. And by extension of that, we're also people who are linked in our shared interests in the general truths of situations which a particular event or trauma might register. So I've always thought of psychoanalytic writing of one kind or another and poetic writing of one kind or another as being like cousins, really, because they have these shared aims in view. Though there are various crucial differences between them, having established those similarities or registered those similarities. And I guess the main one is that whereas we might go into therapy ourselves or talk socially with a therapist or read Freud or whoever it might be to achieve some sort of understanding of things in a... You're going to want to talk to me more about this when it's time for questions, I realise, but read those things in a way which allows us to achieve some sort of understanding in a more or less joined up way. We don't quite read poetry in that spirit. We read poetry not because we think that it's going to tell us something we didn't know, not because it's going to deliver us a truth which hasn't been evident to us in some way or other before, but in order for the language of the poem to surprise us back into a new knowledge of that truth. In other words, my view is that we more often read poems to be reminded of something that we've forgotten we knew, rather than to discover something that we absolutely didn't know before we started off. And I think that perhaps is, there is some difference in this, which is to do with, precisely to do with analysis. You are interested in analysis. We poets are not so interested in analysis, but in recreation, which then might allow analysis to occur, but that's somehow further down the track. So that's the first thing that I wanted to respond to in what you were saying. The next thing, and perhaps it's the only thing I should say, because otherwise I'll just talk for the rest of the night and then it'll be time to go home, is that I think there is something very important and interesting to say about the way in which writing is or is not therapeutic. This is something that you touched on. I don't expect the writing that I produce myself to be at all therapeutic. I don't expect it to be that. It might happen to be that, but I don't set out to write in order for it to be that. I write in order to see what it is in my mind, to try and establish connections between the apparently disparate things, and this is again something that you touched on, but not in too knowing a way, because that again is the job of an analyst and not of a poet to establish precisely what those connections might be. To surprise myself back into familiarity with something that has hitherto been too familiar to be noticeable, all the things that I was talking about a second ago. But I don't, as I say, I don't expect it to be, to submit to analysis in the same sort of way that you do. In other words, I think there are important links between our activities, but also important separations. And just in the matter of writing being therapeutic, although I can't expect it to do me any good writing these poems, I'm also very happy to concede and often spend a lot of my professional life actually encouraging certain sorts of writing to occur in contexts where I think it can do therapeutic good around people who have illnesses of one kind or another, in hospitals, in prisons, addressing certain sorts of disadvantage. But I don't primarily, when I'm encouraging all that and taking part in it myself, expect self-sufficient works of art to be the reward of the activity. I expect the reward to be more in the healing that it might do to the people who are involved in it. In other words, there are more reasons than writing in such contexts than the production of masterpieces.
I'm not so sure that I actually think that that analysis doesn't actually share some of that. While someone may be expressing about themselves that they, you know, would be seeking relief and an understanding that might integrate, even trying to achieve some kind of cathartic effect by sharing it, I do actually wonder, you know, whether it comes closer, maybe even follows to some extent what happens in, say, literature and poetry, in terms of actually trying to elaborate or get further into what is understood and the kind of complexities of that.
Or what is not understood, presumably, too.
Yeah.
I have a very Keatsian view about this, as you would not be surprised to hear me say, since I've spent so much of my life thinking about Keats. But Keats's idea of negative capability, the famous idea of negative capability, which is essentially the willingness to be surrounded by irreconcilable things and be happy about that and not try and sort of tease them out into some definitive solution, seems to me to go absolutely to the centre of what a lot of writers are trying to do a lot of the time, poets particularly. But if you're saying that to me as an analyst, that is something that you're prepared to... Well, I can see that you might be prepared to allow it in the people that you're treating, but I guess a lot of the people who come and talk to you do want some more definite answer than that. I mean, they want to know what the matter is and then go and do something about it in a way that poetry doesn't feel a responsibility to do.
I understand that. But I suppose I still think that an analysis that actually leads up a blind alley in too quickly, a too quick, irritable searching after knowledge and fact, in the Keatsian sense, is likely to go adrift and up a blind alley.
Yeah, I can see that.
And but we've moved on a bit to Keats and. I wondered if you wanted to say a bit more about that. I was perhaps going to lead on into reading a poem, but perhaps you can do that later. Sure. Do you want to do it later, or?
I'll do it when I'm
asked.
When I'm asked.
Should I ask you a bit about your Keats biography? Because actually,
yeah,
that was the first book of yours that I read, and you know, very.
He's in the room.
He's coming back.
Good, at last.
And I was in fact, you know, led to read your book partly because of puzzling about this issue of negative capability. Yeah. And, you know, having read other things on Keats that were massively interesting, but more or less completely baffling, such as Christopher Ricks on Keats.
You know,
it is a brilliant book, but it's
really,
it's
really see something in Keats.
It is very difficult to understand,
yes.
but to try and, but I very much enjoyed reading that your book, and felt, I don't know, I felt also you were a historian as well as a poet.
Well, you have to make yourself into a historian if you're going to write biography in a proper way. And to a certain extent, you have to turn yourself into a therapist as well.
Yeah.
In fact, good biographies, almost by definition, I think, pull together all these different kinds of disciplines and combine them.
But I wonder if you want to say something about that book, because I did find that a very interesting book.
Yeah, well, I can say this about it, that the first biography that I wrote was of Philip Larkin, whom I'd known at the University of Hull when I taught there in the second half of the 1970s. And when Larkin died in 1985, and our friendship had survived the time of our being together in Hull, and then the time that I'd left Hull, and he'd asked me to become one of his literary executors. I wrote that book about somebody that I, in some sense, had known quite well, but in other ways had hardly known at all. I mean, I shouldn't say too much about that right now, because that will lead us away from the question you're asking me. But anyway, so I had written biography before, and indeed before I wrote my Larkin book, I'd written, in a rather Larkin-esque spirit, a book about three generations of a family called Lambert, which horribly bear out Larkin's idea about how hands-on misery to man down the generations. But when I finished writing my Larkin book, I still then, which I don't anymore now, had an appetite for writing orthodox biography. So I said to myself and then to my publishers, Faber and Faber, who, what shall I write about next? And I answered this question in the most direct way, which was to say to myself that the poet that I'd always loved most intensely was the person I should write about, and that was Keats. I only started reading poems in my mid-teens, having not come from an at all literary family. And I guess I liked Keats back then for the same reasons that most people like Keats when they're teenagers, which is that he kind of is one. And he talks to you in your own, in a version of your own language all the time, emotionally speaking. I mean, not so much language, because clearly a language of 200 years ago doesn't sound like the language we use now, but emotionally he feels hot, urgent, despairing, eager, yearning, troubled, in ways which are distinctly recognisable to young people. And it is his genius to make those, or part of his genius, to make those essentially young feelings belong in adult life as well. So I can imagine reading Keats when I'm 90, if I get to be 90, and feeling just as clearly spoken to by him as I do now, and that is an extraordinary thing for him to have done. Anyway, I was keen to do it, and Faber were keen for me to do it, but they were a bit anxious about what the hell there might be new to say about Keats, to which my answer was quite brisk, because even though, as you've indicated, there are wonderful existing biographies of Keats, two very good American ones by Bate and Eileen Ward, and one very good English one by Robert Gittings. None of those books had been interested in the idea that Keats might have had a political existence. And it had always seemed to me, rightly or wrongly, that Keats was in all kinds of fascinating ways a politically engaged person, and that this had been missed for various reasons, partly because the mid-Victorians who made his reputation more or less had to suppress it in order to get him to be accepted into the canon. I mean, I've just cut a long and complicated story very short in saying that, but essentially that's what it is. And partly because Keats, unlike Shelley, Blake, the young Wordsworth and Coleridge, did not come to the front of the page and tell us what he thought about political matters, but in a much more nearly and learned from Shakespeare way, Shakespearean, learned from Shakespeare way, had decided to embed these beliefs, interests, passions in his poems in a way which made them comparatively easy to miss unless you were sort of sensitized to this way of proceeding. We hate poetry, Keats says, doesn't he, in one of his letters. We hate poetry that has a palpable design on us. So he avoids a palpable design in the poems. But nevertheless, these things are there. And I thought it would be very interesting to try and pull them out. And that's what I tried to do. I loved writing this book. It was a completely absorbing, utterly engrossing thing to do. I was happier as a writer during that time than I think at that stage than I'd ever been, because it meant that I could get up in the morning and spend my day with this great writer who was also a great human being, the most generous, good fun, sociable, friendly, but a genius person you could imagine. I mean, he is absolutely like that for me. I mean, Jesus Christ was a good person, but Keats was a very good person as well. He's right up there with Jesus Christ in my reading of things, without the religion, a big relief. In fact, a heroic resister of religion, particularly in the last days of his life, a heroic resister of religion, and one of the things that I most like about him. So it was really a treat to write that book. But nevertheless, for all its pleasures and fascinations, a book which completely exhausted my patience with beginning at the beginning and going on until the end and then stopping biography. I really cannot imagine writing such a book again, though I can easily imagine writing more biography again, but not the whole story in that sense. I mean, to get at the whole story by more partial or keyhole means is now much more interesting to me.
Yes, and also you worked in quite a lot of your own thoughts and interpretations of his work.
Of course, I mean, of course.
Very interesting for that.
Well, a person writing biography doesn't want to, in Lytton Strachey's famous phrase, interpose their body too much between the subject and the reader. But of course, they're absolutely everywhere. And in a sense, this was a more acute problem writing about Larkin, because he was somebody that I'd known, who I could have, if I'd had a mind to, have included sort of personally structured stories about those evenings we sat watching the telly, blah, blah. But I didn't want to personalize it in that way. I wanted to sort of let him loose in a larger sense. So what I did with those personal witnessings that I had and those personal memories was simply to sort of leak them through the book in a way which didn't make me seem as though I was interposing myself.
Yes. I was going to ask you about Larkin and what you thought of him. I mean, he
then,
is,
you mean, or now?
Both. Because I know, I think he's influenced you in terms of,
I'd
you
be
know,
very
your,
weird if he
your,
hadn't.
Your poetry. You know, the idea of not setting out with a fixed kind of purpose or set of ideas, but following the experience and expressing it as closely and simply in some ways as possible.
Well, certainly I'm interested in the simplicity that he manifests, though, of course, he's not the only person who's influenced me in that respect. I mean, behind him are a lot of people who helped him to shape that Hardy, for instance. I mean, it's long been my ideal to write a poem which looked like a glass of water but turned out to be gin. an idea that Larkin himself might quite like. Before, or between about 6 and 8 o'clock in the evening anyway, and then it would have to be another, a different sort of idea. But we can see various other writers in what we loosely call the English tradition, the English line, feeding that idea into him and then him making his own version of it. And so that certainly is something I learned from him and wanted to carry on. Well, he's somebody who, in all kinds of political and social ways, even when we were at our most friendly together and seeing most of each other, I found myself not able to agree with about all kinds of things. my politics and not his politics, both in the sort of capital P way and in the small p way. So by and large, we avoided talking about those things. He knew that I didn't agree with him about all those things, so we simply missed all that stuff out. So it was a friendship with a hole in it, in that respect. But it was a friendship that I wanted to maintain because the good things about it were so wonderful. He was the funniest person I ever met. He was a very good person to work with in an institution because he was the rudest person about the other people in the institution who neither of us liked and who were by common consent not likable. And he'd written these extraordinary poems. And it was, well, I thought and think extraordinary. In fact, my opinion of his poems rises steadily as I get older. I think if you want to read poems of that kind, I mean, in arising from that tradition, and in roughly that tone of voice, they're very hard to beat. I think they are really wonderful poems. And I think for all the complications that bubble into them from the dyspeptic and worse sides of his private life, nevertheless, there are plenty of things that he has to say about the general condition of life, which I find very agreeable. I don't mean, I'm not talking about politics when I say this, but I'm talking about death. And the difficulties of death in particular, I must say, and the difficulties of loving. He is brilliant about both those things. I mean, the man who wrote, "Whether or not we use it, it goes," has said something in a memorable way which we will carry with us to the rest of our lives.
He's very surprising in that respect. I was struck by the Arundel tomb.
Yes.
You know, how to bring something from something that...
Absolutely.
Bring some meaning from something that was
absolutely
dead, forgotten stone.
And saying it in such a beautiful way that you don't forget it.
Yes.
I mean, what else do we want poetry to do? Well, there are, of course, certain other things that we want poetry to do, but that is, I mean, to say something true and memorable, that's pretty good.
Yeah. Can I move on to not this one. Yes, this one, The Invention of Dr. Cake, which I liked very much. It follows. It's for those of you who haven't read it. I'm not going to say too much, but it follows a sort of imaginary fictional situation of a doctor doing a survey of the conditions of the rural poor, and going out into the reaches of Essex. And
the village I grew up in fact.
Yeah, well, I was noticing the autobiographical, yes, aspects of some of this.
Yes.
And the hints.
Yes, I've sort of blown my own cover in this.
Yeah. But one of the things that kind of struck me was something else, which I think, you know, it was very much coming out of your work on Keats, and that is the sort of, as it were, transportation into another world, a world of fantasy, a world of mystery, a world of uncertainty in terms of where one is, what's happened, and so on. And there is a passage I would like you to read. Have you got your copy?
I haven't got my copy, but I have got my glasses.
All right. And it's really, in a way, not to spill too much of the story, it's a sort of account which begins to conjure up the notion that Keats may still have been alive, that he didn't die young, and that somehow he began writing poetry again. But he largely spent his time as a doctor in rural Essex. And, of course, it's a fable, in a way. It's a fictional,
yes,
story.
He decides... He doesn't die. I mean, the idea is that he doesn't die in Rome in 1921. In 1821, he comes back to a bit of a George Bush moment there. He comes back to England, changes his name to Cake, and becomes a GP. So somewhere at the centre of the book is a conversation that I wanted to have about the relative merits of good words, right? Producing good words, of a life spent producing good words, as opposed to a life doing good deeds, saving other people's lives.
Okay, so I mean, I don't think just reading this bit will actually convey what I want to what I felt was there, but because you've got to read the build-up to it and the transition, I think, between the more prosaic account and moving into something more uncertain and so on. But this is the period of that bit there, and then this bit from there over to I hope you don't mind me cutting.
No, not at all, no. It's such a long book. No, quite. Always cut. It's true, one always should. If in two minds, always cut. I was just looking because I was trying to remember quite where we were. I think this is the second. He makes two visits to the house, the man who's narrating this, who is, as Dennis says, amid. Well, it's a third of the way through the 19th century doctor who's interested in TB, and he's come to interview Dr. Cake. He's a sort of failed poet himself, and he's come to interview Dr. Cake because he wants to get Cake's experience of, thank you, of treating TB. And what, in the first encounter, because he's interested in poems, he, who's, and his name is Dr. Tabor, becomes fascinated by the idea that this man might be John Keats. Sort of, how mad is that? But is it? Could it be? And then in the second time, he goes back to him and he sneaks around the house at some point and looks in through the window and so on. Keats is living there alone, or Cake, I should say, is living there alone with his housekeeper, who's a sort of variant on the woman who was the housekeeper in Keats' house when Keats was living there with Charles Brown in Hampstead. I've called her Mrs. Riley here. She's Irish, like the housekeeper was in Keats' house. So this is Tabor writing this down. During the confusion I had suffered on my journey to the house, I had felt the usual boundaries of experience loosen. Now, with my face pressed to the glass of the doctor's window, I felt that I had slipped outside life entirely and could convey its conditions and limits. The experience was demoralizing and quickening in equal parts. I walked like someone in a trance, the cool, moist twilight rippling over my face, my feet scarcely seeming to touch the ground. The effect was to redouble the sensation which had previously affected me in the lane. But for a reason I had no curiosity to explain, it no longer generated a feeling of solitude, rather of integration and belonging, as though I had become a part of the silent kingdom around me, the universe of drooping leaves and soaked grass blades, of sleeping birds and blundering moths. The glasshouse door stood ajar, and I squeezed through without altering its position and stepped onto the brick floor. The air immediately wrapped itself round me like a warm bandage. It was not simply the fact that it had stewed all the long summer's day which made it so palpable. It was the added burden of flower scent which weighed me down. The doctor's orchids, nearly visible in spite of the darkness of the hour, seemed to turn inquiringly towards me. Some were shaped like the open mouths of snakes, exposing the pale interior of their throats. Others were like miniature bells. Others again resembled caps or bonnets, and all were the colour of fantasy, not of life. Deep royal purples, pulsing yellow, spotted with blood flecks, crimson blushing into magenta. When I had first glimpsed them across the garden a few weeks before, they had seemed exotic and delightful. Now they were obviously repellent, rearing on spindly stalks, shockingly bare of surrounding leaves, though with some flopping from the mossy earth round each base. They seemed to hiss, or gasp, or pant, or in some other way to strain upon the atmosphere, as if to appear breathless with their natural condition. Faced with such a phantasmagoria, the dullest mind would soon shift its thinking from the flowers themselves to their owner and curator. I did so immediately. I imagined the doctor in the candle-lit cavern of his bed, his shining head propped on the pillow, perhaps at this moment accepting a glass offered by Mrs. Riley. He would not live to see the flowers he had nurtured shrivel on their stalks and fall. I understood that. What I did not know, what no man could ever truly know about another, was the exact mood of his reflections on the subject. In my own work as a doctor, I have seen hundreds die, men, women, and children, and have been astonished by the diversity of their response. Wizened old Stoics have become blubbering infants. Infants have become Stoics. Devout virgins have turned clamorous for the life they denied when it was full of opportunity. Sinners have shown a greater understanding of virtue than clerics who made it their whole study. I have been able to draw only one conclusion from my observations, that our greatest human talent is our gift for ignoring death while we are still secure in our possession of life, and that as soon as our hold is weakened, and we know it must soon be broken, we discover aspects of ourselves that we previously did not know existed. In this respect, our deaths may be considered our greatest moment of revelation and produce a self-knowledge which it is our tragedy never to enjoy. Truly, the greatest secret we take to our graves is the understanding of ourselves.
Thank you.
I've forgotten all of that.
Well, it does bring together that awareness of sensuous experience and reaching into the unknown and grasping to understand that I think is very Keatsian, actually.
Well, it's meant to be, of course, and, yeah. And it does quite knowingly arise out of thinking about his fascinating and absolutely compelling connections between the life of the senses and death itself, which is the moment, of course, that our senses give up on us, or that we give up on them, but nevertheless has in a lot of Keats's poems a sort of voluptuarian's climactic feel about it. And that's what I was interested in catching there.
Can I move on to the memoir?
Yes.
And In the Blood, and spend the last period on that. That this is very much centred around the first couple of chapters, and then the last couple of chapters are about the real life occurrences, the day of, and then the day after. Your mother had a tragic accident when you were in your mid-teens. And then throughout the middle chapters, very much looking at the span of things that have happened in childhood and the growing up to that point. I think there are many features of this memoir that are both very moving but also understated, somehow trying to be true to the view of a child, as you were obviously throughout much of it, and then as a mid-adolescent. And I'm also when, I don't know how much people know about your actual biography, your real life, as it were, that after this terrible accident, your mother was in a coma for many years. And these were actually the years in which you were developing as a poet. Well, you were developing your interest in literature and your degree and teaching and writing your first poetry. And there are a number of poems all the way through, really, about this.
There are.
I suppose, you know, the question is, why did he want to write this memoir?
Well, that's a good question. Though it doesn't sound all that, but it is a good question. I'd been trying to write it ever since my mother had her accident, in one way or another. I'd written various short pieces of prose. As you say, I'd written a lot of poems about her in particular and about childhood in general, and my own childhood mainly, but other people's childhoods to a lesser extent. And even though I was quite happy with some of those things, it became increasingly interesting to me to try and join them up into a consecutive narrative. Why that should be so, which is really your question, has something to do with internal artistic considerations, such as feeling a sufficient distance from it to be able to do it. It has something to do simply with ego. It has something to do, and I think this was decisive, actually, with the feeling that we all have as we get older, which is becoming increasingly interested in seeing ourselves as part of a historical process and as being produced by a historical process in all kinds of important ways rather than simply happening out of the blue. Very quickly, just to illustrate that, watching my father run around when I was a child, making sure that we never filled the bath more than half full and turning all the lights out, which just seemed to me sort of stingy or weird when I was little. Now that I'm the age that I am and I can see that this was somebody who'd been brought up on in rather threadbare ways by his own parents and then fought through the war and then crucially experienced his early manhood during a time of rationing. Of course that he was going to do this. This was absolutely in his blood to behave in this sort of way. So simply to become aware of little things like that as having historical motivations or conditionings, let alone the larger things too, does become interesting. And I simply wanted to write those things down and leave them as a record in case they chimed with other people, which I'm happy to say they seem to have done in all kinds of ways. So those are really the reasons for doing it at all. The reasons for doing it as I did it were differently complicated. Because I'd written a lot of biography before I came to writing my own story, I had become very fascinated and frustrated in more or less equal parts by the sense that if only I could have talked to Keats, for instance, when he was alive and said, I can find the stuff in the record, by consulting the public record, but just tell me about those afternoons when you felt the world change on its axis, which nobody else knows about. Tell me about the important but insignificant seeming things. Tell me, to use Wordsworth's famous word for it or phrase for it, tell me about the spots of time that we experience as children, to which on which our adult personalities are to a great extent founded. But not being able to have those conversations with the people who had previously been my subjects, I certainly could have them with myself. So what I tried to do was to construct the book around such insignificant seeming but actually very vital and adult forming episodes. Wordsworth is the key person here because Wordsworth is the first person to do such a thing. Wordsworth is the person who writes about, who makes a big deal of stealing a boat, which looks like nothing in particular, but is actually a very, very crucially determining moral episode for him. In other words, just in the sense that I'm talking now, the decision to write the book as I did write it was to try and excavate those insignificant-seeming moments and give them the value that they truly, for all of us, do have. Again, in the hope that I would be true to myself in so doing, but also allow other people to consult themselves about what similar episodes might have been life-forming for them. And then there was something else as well, which is to say that I wanted to write a book which was, in some sense, a manifestation, a late manifestation of childhood, as well as being an account of it, in this sense that because I can remember my early childhood very clearly, uncannily clearly, painfully clearly, actually, sometimes, which is all to do with the way that my mother's accident seemed to sort of seal it for me in a kind of giant marmalade jar. I thought it would be interesting to write it as though I was still, in some sense, a child. So there is no retrospection in this book. There's no wisdom after the event. There's no if I knew then what I know now. There's no interrogation of my young self by my older self. Stuff just happens. The gain, I hoped, would be freshness, truth to life, all those kinds of things. And also a rather kind of wonderful letting myself off the hook of having to deal with un-PC things, because why should a child bother with any of that? A great relief. The loss would be that there would be, on the face of it, the loss would be that there would be no adult understanding of what was happening. Actually, I think an adult reading it, and any adult reading it, would of course be aware of the fact that this was a piece of artifice, though it might seem to be natural, would probably be able to get the goods that they wanted out of it anyway.
I think that that's interesting, the doing it as if and in the language of you as a child. I certainly noticed the contrast of some of the poems that you've written, which where there is the adult looking back, and also there's some of the adult depression and despairing and emotion that are there. I mean, some of these poems were written at the time, weren't they? Very much.
Yes. Some of them were written while she was still alive.
There's a lot to say about this. I just want to say one thing, because I know we've got to open this up in a minute. I'd like you to read a poem that I think one of the things that struck me, I mean, there is a very telling and evocative picture of your mother. And I did feel that perhaps, that you know, speaking as a child or recording your memories as a child did actually evoke her in a way that felt very real.
Well,
she
I'm
became
very,
very real as a person.
Good.
So one could kind of like her and dislike her, you know,
Good.
The way she was snobby about the snotty boys down the street.
Well, she was snobby about a lot of most things.
But also that warmth and the closeness, the Oedipal closeness and so on.
Yes, and sort of, I mean, not precisely a liar, but a tremendous exaggerator.
Yeah.
So every time anybody ever asks me where I think my poems come from, I think that's probably got a lot to do with it. Her exaggerations.
Can I put one last poem? This is Serenade, and then I think we'll finish.
Yes, I'll read that. Well,
this is Serenade is the horse, in fact, that your mother rode.
Yes. Well, this was a country childhood. I mean, for those of you who don't know this book, my brother and I grew up in a village on the borders of Essex and Suffolk, or close to the borders of Essex and Suffolk, about a quarter of an hour sort of down from what was in his own time called Constable Country. So pretty. And in those days, still quite cut off feeling. I mean, not so much now. It is still a sort of pretty little bubble, but much more encroached upon than it was in 40 years ago. So it's set there, and there was a guy who used to come and do what was called cold shoeing when the pony's hooves flew off. So I don't want you to imagine anything like Joe Gargery here. This is not a sort of flaming forge. This is just a skinny little fellow who used to turn up and do cold shoeing in the driveway. And most of this poem, which in Larkin's terrifying phrase goes on over the page, so you've been warned, is just about that. It's about the farrier. And then latterly it's about her and about that weird moment that happens to us if we're lucky, I suppose, in our lives of realising that we're the age that our parents were when they were dead. Serenade. There were the two ponies and there was Serenade, which belonged to my mother. Though who belonged would be better, in view of the girlish head lift she had, and her flounce to and fro in the lumpy field, and that big womanish rump I always gave a wide berth to. When the blacksmith came to shoe her, which was seldom in summer, but otherwise often, she would let him hoist and stretch out first one hind leg, and then the other, with a definitely melancholy, embarrassed restraint. The blacksmith was ferret-faced and rat-bodied, hardly man enough to keep aloft the great weight of one foot at a time, though he did keep it sort of aloft, crouched over double and bent at the knees to make a peculiar angle which held each hoof still on his battle-scarred apron. He would set up shop under the covered entranceway between our house and the stable block, a ramshackle, clabbered affair, black or black weathering to green, with swallows' mud villages proliferating in the rafters. I liked it there in the drive-through, which was also where we parked the car, but not on his days, for the oil maps on the dusty cement, brilliant as the wet skin of a trout, and for the puzzling swallow-shit patterns, and most of all for that place by the corner drain where a grass snake had appeared once, an electric green, sleepy-looking marvel, which, when it disappeared, left a print of itself that stayed in the mind forever. The blacksmith always did cold shoeing, prizing off each thin moon crescent, then carving the hoof with a bone-handled, long-bladed knife. The miracle of no pain. Serenade gone loose in her skin, her strength out of her, so she seemed suspended in water. Her hypnotized breathing steady, the smell of piss and musty hay and ammonia sweat coming off her. Her head dropping down, eyes half closed now, and me a boy, watching the earth-stained sole of her hoof, turning pure white as the blacksmith pared and trimmed, leaving the nervous diamond of the frog well alone, but showing me, just by looking, how even to touch that, much worse cut it, would wake her and break the spell and our two heads with it. Our collie dog sat near where the snake had been, ravenous black and white, all ears, sometimes fidgeting her two slim front feet, glancing away as if about to dash off, then twisting back, licking her lips and swallowing with a half whine. She knew better than to get under anyone's feet. But when the blacksmith had done with his cutting and offered a new shoe and fiddled it downwards or sideways and hammered it with quick hits which drove the nail points clean through, but these could be filed off later and were. When this was all done, he kicked the clippings across the cement, and now it was the collie's turn to show a sad restraint, taking one delicate piece between her pink lips, ashamed to be a slave of appetite, and curving away into the yard to eat it in private. The blacksmith straightened himself, one hand smoothing the small of his back, the other picking a few remaining nails from between his own darker lips, then slapped Serenade on the flank with his red palm, rousing her from her trance, running his fingers up her mane and over her ears, giving each a soft tug and saying, "She'll do," or "Good lady," or "There's a girl." Whereupon my mother herself appeared to pay him. Their hands met and touched and parted, and something passed between them, and the blacksmith took off his apron with its colours of a battered tin bowl, folded it and carried it before him in a lordly fashion, using it as a cushion for his collapsed bag of hammers, clippers, knives, files, pliers and nails to the van, which he had parked in the lane some distance from us, while my mother untied the halter and led her horse away. There was a crisp clip-clop over the stable yard, and a train of hoofprints with the neat shoes obvious to me, who had stayed behind with nothing better to do than look. This was Serenade, who would later throw my mother as they jumped out of a wood into sunlight, and who, taking all possible pains not to trample her down or even touch her, was nevertheless the means to an end, which was death. Now I am as old as my mother was then, at the time of her fall, and I can see Serenade clearly in her own later life. Poor, dumb creature, nobody blamed, or could easily like any more either, which meant nobody came to talk to her much in the spot she eventually found under the spiky may tree in the field, and still less came to shoe her, so her hooves grew long and crinkled round the edges like wet cardboard, except they were hard. While she just stood there, not knowing what she had done, or went off with her girlish flounce and conker-coloured arse, waiting for something important to happen. Only nothing ever did, beyond the next day and the next, and one thing leading to another. Thank you. I think it's over to you.